So recently, the Tennessean, my first place of employment, added a ton of its archives to the newspapers.com database. And today I discovered a 1993 piece I wrote as an intern about Shelbyville, Tennessee, and an event called the Tennessee Walking Horse National Celebration. I don't actually recall writing the story, but it sucks. I mean, it's just me cracking horse jokes and pretending I understand a subject I knew nothing about. And looking back, that's a big thing I changed. And I encourage younger writers to really think about it. Don't write around facts. Don't think your magical pen can cover up for limited knowledge. Delve, inquire, ask and ask and ask again. Or else you too can write manure like, unlike the thoroughbreds who speed around the racetrack at an eye-popping rate, walking horses are all about style and elegance. Ugh, you've been warned, kiddos. You've been warned. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. Today's guest is Chip Brantley, the University of Alabama journalism professor and the co-host and writer of my all-time favorite investigative podcast, NPR's White Lies, which delves into the 1965 unsolved murder of the Reverend James Reeb in Selma, Alabama. Trust me, it's good. This is episode number 207. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks. You're losing your hair.
All right, Chip, I reached out to you because a mutual friend of ours named Ashley Brower said to me, there's this, my friend Chip, he did this podcast. It's called White Lies. And you go through life these days, if you listen to podcasts, and everyone has a podcast to recommend to you. And everyone, oh, it's the best podcast. And I couldn't stop listening to this thing. I mean, I was as absorbed by this podcast, and I've told about 20 people about it. And I just think it's masterful. I know you've heard this shit and you're like, oh yeah, I get it. Everyone likes a podcast. But like, as a journalist, it hit me in every place. Like it just did. And I want to start with this. I feel like, especially in the modern age, we're all in a rush. We're in a rush to tweet. We're in a rush to get out our takes. Even with books, you know, all right, you got a year and a half. You got to get this out in a year and a half. This thing seems like the ultimate exercise in patience and patience and patience and patience. Is it tough to be patient? Is it tough to be like, all right, we're going to need 3 years. We're going to need 4 years. It seems like it would be excruciatingly difficult just to have that with a project like this.
First of all, thank you for having me. Thanks for listening to the show. Appreciate that. Thanks for telling people about it. I'm incapable of brief, concise answers, but the way that whole thing unfolded really was a sort of happy accident, and that Andy, my partner, Andy and I, who also, we both teach at the University of Alabama, we've collaborated on a bunch of things, and we started teaching this class in, 2013, 2014, I can't remember when we first started, but it was a year-long class where the idea was that we would work together with students on a narrative project of some kind and sort of let the medium choose itself, basically, after we'd done enough reporting, kind of figure out how we're going to put the story together. And so the first year we did it, the previous spring, we had talked to Brian Stevenson, who's a lawyer here in Alabama. He's the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, the sort of force behind the lynching memorial and Montgomery that opened several years ago. Just an incredible, incredible guy. Wrote the book Just Mercy. It's been made into a movie. Anyway, we at the time, this is sort of before Brian Stevenson was Brian Stevenson, we went and met with him to talk about if you had a client whose story we could work on, basically. Kind of typical Innocence Project move. We thought that would be an appropriate first year for this class, given Alabama's justice system, you know, sort of consistently at the very bottom of the pile when it comes to equity and fairness. So we went down that route and ended up working on the story for 5-6 months with students. And then in sort of in the middle of that process, something happened in this case that made Brian revisit our access and basically pulled our access for all good reasons, having to do with being a great lawyer and having his clients' interests first. But what that experience did was it made us think, okay, we need to do something more historical next year. We can't be, if we're going to do a year-long class with students who have some expectation of finishing something, we need to do something we feel confident we can finish. So it just so happened that next year was 2014, 2015. academic year. And 2015 was the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday and all the voting rights campaign in Selma. And as a Birmingham native who lives in Birmingham now, we had just sort of been through a lot of the similar commemorations of the 50th anniversary, the Children's Crusade in 1963, and of course the church bombing and all the major moments of the Birmingham campaign. So we thought maybe we should try to find something that could, you know, tie into to that. And we just so happened to talk to Jerry Mitchell, who was a sort of legendary cold case reporter out of Jackson, Mississippi. He had come to the University of Alabama to give a talk, and we both knew Jerry in kind of roundabout ways. And just mentioned to him that we were thinking about doing something. He's like, you should look into this Reed case. This case from that March 1965. It's really interesting. No one's really ever done a deep dive into it. I would love to, but I'm in Mississippi, I'm not in Alabama. And, you know, several hours makes a big difference in your ability to do something like that. And so we started looking into it really right off the bat for with students at next year as a storytelling challenge. It's like, this is history. We just need to kind of come up with an interesting way to tell it. You know, we didn't really have any expectation of spending years working on it or discovering anything new for that matter. And so we made a pretty straightforward, like 10-minute documentary that ran as a New York Times op doc, mostly focusing on one of the men who was with the central figure in the story that is we tell in White Lies, this man, Clark Olson, who had lived with this event for 50 years. And it was about his memories and about the way that he reconciled this event with other events from that time, specifically events that took the lives of local Black folks in Birmingham, in Alabama, as opposed to sort of white people who came down during the movement. What we discovered in the course of doing this pretty straightforward documentary project is that there were new elements to the story that have been told pretty often over the years in the same kind of way. And that because of our proximity to Selma, you know, just physically, and because we live here, because we kind of speak the language, we can talk about, you know, Alabama football and Auburn football to the cows come home. We were able to just luxuriate in that and sort of had the privilege of kind of going down there time and again and just sitting with people and really doing the kind of things that you used to do as like a beat reporter, you know, just spending a lot of time on the beat talking to people. Didn't really know where it was going or if we'd ever be able to do anything with it. And in the meantime, started working on a totally different project that we were thinking of as a podcast, a narrative serialized podcast that we made a pilot of that we began pitching everybody, including NPR. And in the course of that pitching that to people, we mentioned, you know, if you like this story and we do this story, there are these other stories we could do, one of which was this story. So this was in early 2017. Trump's just been elected. White nationalism is on everyone's mind. And our contact at NPR, Nigeria Eaton, who had come from the independent film world and knew Andy from that world, his background is a documentarian, was like, the story pitch is interesting, but I really want to talk about this civil rights cold case story and this exploration of whiteness. And, you know, let's talk about that. So we began that process and, you know, 6 months later, we were working on it full time. So, and that was a whole, that process of getting NPR to sort of bite was interesting because there were certain people who were in the show. You can probably guess who they are, who we did not have on the record, who would not go on the record. And they basically said, if you can get them to go on the record, we'll do it. If you can't, we just don't think there's any way to do it. And they were right. There would have been no way to do the story without certain people saying to us on the record what they knew. So in some ways, that patience that I think really paid off in terms of our reporting, it was sort of forced on us in a way, or it sort of was an accident. I mean, we say we worked on it for 5 years, which is true, but it was, you know, it was off and on where we're working on other projects as well.
Is there a moment when you know this is going to work? Obviously you have an idea and you know, it's a good idea and blah, blah, blah. When you just like this, we have something different here.
Totally. Yeah. For this one, for sure. It's when we got, so this, the main person that NPR wanted us to get on the record is this witness to this crime that happened in 1965. She's been a bail bondsman in Selma for forever. Her name is Frances Bowden. And we met her early and we would just come in. It's crazy. We called her the Sphinx of Washington Street because she worked on Washington Street where this crime happened in 1965 for years. As a waitress, and she worked in a pawn shop, and then she's been a bail bondswoman on the street for, I don't know, 3 decades. And she's just been, you know, her whole like adult life has been on this corner where this crime happened. It's just fascinating. So while we're talking to her, she's looking out at the space where the crime happened and can talk about it, you know, with a kind of recall that I think a lot of people who we just tend to lose that recall over time, you know, as time goes on, our memory fades. But she's been living that space, you know, for most of her adult life. So NPR basically said, like, if you can get her to go on the record, we'll do it. And so we, you know, kept going back. She would agree and then not show up. And so one Tuesday we're down in Selma and we just said, we walked in and we're like, let's just do it. Just, you know, just tell us what you, even if it's just partial, even if you don't want to tell us everything, let's sit down and just tell us kind of what you remember. You don't even have to name names, like just let's just start somewhere and see where it goes. So we sat down thinking we were going to get kind of a, like, you know, short first interview that would at least show NPR that we had a relationship with her and that over time we might be able to get her to tell us more. And we sat down and we were there for 3 hours. And she told us everything. I mean, it was incredible. And there was a moment during it, like we sat down and she's across her desk smoking, chain smokes Winston 100s. And she's sitting there smoking. We're kind of asking her these softball questions to kind of just, you know,
yeah,
get her going and like, let's talk. And we've done this before. Now we're just having a recorder going. It's not a big deal, you know. And within about 30 minutes, she named names and sort of told us everything. And then at one point she had to get up and like go use the restroom. And I'll never forget, Andy and I just sort of looked at each other for the first time because we're both there doing the interview. And we were like, you know, kind of made the like quiet, oh my God face. And at that moment we knew we had the story. I mean, because she was the critical witness to it. For, you know, there's a complicated story in a lot of ways. And so there's some things that are you know, kind of too long to go into here, but she definitely was the critical person for us. And so once we got her, we kind of knew, okay, that's it.
I mean, I just think one of the great tasks of journalism is getting people to agree to open up and getting people to go on the record. And people have different devices and tricks and blah, blah, blah. And there's definitely an element of salesmanship and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. You got a lot of people to talk who really, there was no benefit to them to talk except to hear themselves talk. Is there a way to do it that works? Have you come up with a way that works?
Yeah. I mean, this one was tricky because you're right. I mean, there were people who could implicate themselves, who could get themselves into legal trouble because they talked to us. And we were mindful of that and never wanted to, you know, I hear myself saying what I'm about to say, and I kind of don't believe myself, but this is what I tell myself. Like, you know, we're always honest and upfront with people. And especially for people like this who they're not Bo Jackson, you know, they're not public figures. They're living their private lives and most of them have never talked to the media, distrust the media. And so what we tried to do was both sort of be honest and upfront with them at all times and always represent ourselves, you know, as what being there to talk about what we're there to talk about. I mean, we had a little bit of a trick in that when we said to people, we're here to get the truth about what happened to Jim Reed, which is ultimately what we were trying to do. There are people in Selma, many people in Selma, many white people in Selma, who don't believe that the story that's been told about Jim Reed is the truth for other reasons that we dig into. And so, you know, I think we never let on that we believed any of the mythology and any of the sort of what we can call the counter narrative, the conspiracy theories about what happened to him. But at the same time, we could sort of agree that neither of us had, you know, neither of us believed the existing story, that there was more to it. You know, and, you know, very quickly with everybody we talked to, it was apparent that, I mean, first of all, we're with NPR, which one person we tried to talk to who wouldn't talk to us said is the world's largest communist organization. So, I mean, you know, you, when you come up and you're representing NPR and you're beginning to ask questions that very quickly reveal your orientation to the story. I think for us, what really helped is we're white, we're guys, and we're from Alabama, frankly. I mean, a lot of these people are people I've not the individuals, but the type I've known my whole life, you know? And so there's just a way to talk to people, you know, not to say that some other reporter from somewhere else couldn't do it. Cause you know, good reporters and journalists do that stuff all the time. But for us, it helps just to be able to your earlier question, like just show up, you know, I think there's also a thing in Selma where especially the white community in Selma, feels like their city has just been sort of shat upon for the past five decades. You know, like that's all anybody wants to talk about, understandably. And so they're used to every March with the bridge crossing, the Jubilee, they're used to journalists coming into town and writing a story that sort of, you know, is mildly to strongly critical of the city and then leaving. And as one person said, you know, Selma has done more for the civil rights movement than the civil rights movement ever did for Selma. And I think that's a fair critique, you know, not of the civil rights movement, but just of like our using Selma as a punching bag. And so I think when we're able to show up week after week for years, even if it's just for an afternoon, you just become kind of part of the fabric of the city in a way. And that, you know, once you talk to somebody, the jeweler in town who, you know, whose dad worked at the movie theater in 1963, and you can sort of drop that into a conversation with somebody like, oh, you know, it's about Roger Butler's dad. That's interesting. How does he know that? You know, you just start to, I think it was Susan Orlean one time who said in an interview, you start to bump into yourself when you're working on a story like that. You know, you start to like, oh yeah, I heard about you from so-and-so and so-and-so. And you learn the lore of the place and you're able to kind of work that in as you talk to people. And I think that puts people's minds at ease, which is of course all sorcery and trickery, you know? Yeah. I mean, as I hear myself talking about it, I'm like, ooh, that's underhanded, you know? But that's also just, I think, the nature of the work. You just have to reconcile yourself with that.
It's funny, I was in Alabama last week and I was looking for people who knew Bo Jackson, and it was on his old street. And I went to a house and knocked on the door, and the woman said, oh, you should talk to Miss Caroline across the street. And as soon as that woman told me I should talk to Miss Caroline, I knew my odds of getting Miss Caroline were very good, because I could say to Miss Caroline, Stephanie across the street said I should talk to you. And having that person, that even that tiny little reference, it's worth $1 million in interview points.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, a minor little moment in this story was when we were trying to, one of the assailants, one of the suspects from this 1965 crime, the last living defendant from the trial in 1965 died in the course of our reporting the story. And we were trying to find, we had heard rumors about a certain documentation of the trial, and we were going in search of this one man, Saul Tepper, who claims to have, he wrote this letter claiming to have recorded the trial, and where all this sort of fodder for the conspiracy theory that's still alive today and Selma kind of comes from. And somebody told us we needed to talk to this former probate judge, Kim Ballard. And so we went to talk to Kim Ballard and about something else. And in the course of doing it, we're like, oh, you know, it's the Columbo thing. Like, oh, have you ever heard this about a recording of the trial? He's like, yeah, I did hear something about that. And I think this guy, Jim Rutledge, helped him with it. We're like, who? Jim Rutledge? Like, what's his name? And then that sets off this Jim Rutledge, you know, trail where you're just like, Kim Ballard said to call you. And then we talked to that person to call. And then, you know, it's just you follow the crumbs and basically keep using those names to get deeper, and, you know, as Jerry Mitchell told us, like, work the edges, you know. And as you work those edges, you get names and clues that can kind of allow you to get closer and closer to the center.
If you were an African-American guy, could you have possibly gotten these people to open up?
I don't think so. I can't say for sure. I just think, you know, a lot of these white people we talked to, you know, didn't trust us. And I think they're the only reason they did talk to us. I mean, the thing that this working on this revealed to me is how many white people, especially of a certain age, but I think in general, sort of the way white people talk to white people about race versus, especially in a place like Alabama, there's just sort of the shorthand, you know, they just assume in a certain way that you're coming at the story from a way that they don't quite appreciate. They still assume there's a certain assumption that you're coming at the question of race from the same place. And so I just think that there's a kind of comfort that certain white people have with other white people in that setting, you know? So I don't want to say that an African-American reporter couldn't have done it. I just think that given the reluctance of these older white folks to even talk to us, I think it would have been an uphill battle just to get them to sort of sit down with them.
It's interesting. I wrote a story years and years ago for Sports Illustrated about a racist baseball player named John Rocker from Macon, Georgia. And people...
I remember John Rocker.
Yeah. For years and years, people would say, how did you get him to open up? And I always have the same answer. We were two white guys in a car and he wasn't thinking, oh, this is a liberal Jewish New Yorker who's a magazine writer and blah, blah. We're two white guys in a car. And it's weird and sort of pathetic in a way, but kind of weird how that carries a currency.
It's totally. Bizarre. Yeah. I mean, it says a lot, I think, about kind of where we still are as a country. I think, you know, we tell ourselves a lot of stories about race, but I think when you're honest about what you just said, that, you know, the sort of just being white is often the thing that gives you the access you need to get somebody to talk to you, you know, that tells you a lot. I think that, that being white, being from Alabama, again, being able to drop in, you know, knowing, you know, it's ridiculous. It's true everywhere in Alabama. You live in LA, right?
Near LA, yeah.
Near LA. So, I mean, like, you know, the way LA people fetishize, like, their routes, the way they get from one place to another, you know, the old swingers joke about, like, you take the this and the other. Well, Alabama, it's the back roads. You know, like, oh, did you take 5 or, you know, 80 to get here? You know, it's that crap that, like, matters to people. Because if you can do it, if you can fit, you know, sort of fill in that exchange, it really does establish your bona fides, you know, you're, like, here and you can do it.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my son, Emmett, who's been giving me a ton of grief for forgetting Mother's Day this year.
What type of loser doesn't get his wife a gift?
Now, it's not too late. I'm going to run out to Ralph's tonight and buy a dozen roses. They're on sale for $4.99.
Dad, that's awful.
You think 2 dozen roses?
No, there's only one thing that can woo the broken heart of a slighted mother. A Microzier number 30 purple and white Pittsburgh Maulers jersey from 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. Trust me, Dad, go to 503-sports.com, buy our jersey, watch the joy and happiness return to our miserable household.
Oh, man, did you get her a jersey, too?
What do I look like? I got her flowers.
Wait, there are a couple of things I have to ask you about because I'm fascinated. Yeah. All right, so number one, Elmer Cook appears to be the guy who, you know, took the club on Reeves head and blah, blah, blah. And toward the end, I feel like the podcast came out 2 years ago. I can give away a few things.
Yeah.
You track down his grandson, who's a gay New York City resident. Mm-hmm. And I thought you played it really understatedly well, which is I took a great delight in the fact that this racist white guy from Alabama who murdered someone, I can picture his head exploding that his gay grandson lives in wherever it was in New York City and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Queens.
But you didn't make a thing of it. It was clear he was gay. He made it clear he was gay. He made it clear he was upset. But there was no like, dun, dun, dun. The irony is, was that even a thought? Did it just speak for itself? Were you, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us and Drew too, his grandson, are sort of, you know, if you can get outside the story and sort of see the way in which that family has evolved, it's amazing. But yeah, we didn't want to, you know, do the dun 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 for a bunch of reasons. But one is that, you know, ultimately the way that episode works too is that it's sort of a trajectory to his dad, you know, who had to live with Elmer Cook and who, in some ways, is able to sort of think most about the damage that man caused, you know, not just to other people, but to his family. And so, and also the way in which Drew thought about his dad and whether his dad would even entertain the idea of thinking differently about his father, you know? And so we're using him strategically in a way as like a bridge to get somewhere. And so didn't want to linger too much on, there's a great exchange though where I think, I can't remember it exactly. I haven't listened to it since it came out, but that like Andy's basically says something like, it's interesting because, you know, your grandfather is in some ways the like racist monster that people picture when they picture racist Alabama, you know, and like here you are, you know, miles away from it. And Drew really, I mean, you know, Selma was like brutal for him. He got out of there, thank goodness. But yeah, I mean, it was that whole family and then his niece, who we get to Drew from his niece, Katie, who lives here in Birmingham, just graduated from UAB recently, is like this amazing young woman who's, you know, is really into lithography and is an artist and is trying to sort of reconcile her own life with her family's past. And so it's in some ways, I think it's really hopeful, that whole sequence that we're not entirely defined by the people who make us.
You find Bill Portwood, who is now deceased, but he was the fourth guy involved and nobody knew who he was for years and years. And it was this mystery of the fourth guy. And I was fascinated by something in a sort of journalistic, also voyeuristic way, which is you guys find him and his wife is basically I said this to my wife recently, there's no greater ally than the bored senior citizen. The bored senior citizen is the greatest journalistic ally of all. You would agree with this, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. In a way that, makes me sad, but yes. Also you're right. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I don't know where you're going with that, but I think I do, which is the push and pull of this was, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about being very clear with people, is like, I am here to get you to tell me, to admit something that in theory could make you legally, liable. And it was hard to know sometimes whether Bill was, his wife, Ina, the real struggle there was that his wife, Ina, was loved for us to come back. Didn't want to talk on the record for the longest time. Didn't want Bill to talk on the record. And was careful to always say, I wasn't with Bill in 1965. I'm just everything I'm telling you is stuff he told me later. But she wanted us to come because it was good for him to talk to people, And it was like he had had some dementia issues. And so trying to remember stuff and talking was really great for him in terms of his health, and also I think, although Andy and I disagree, I think a lot about people's souls. And I think she also thought it was maybe good for his soul, but who knows? We don't know what people,
I just thought it was a really interesting thing because it was, it was a long shot, but it was theoretically possible. This woman's like, yeah, you should talk to him. He's, he'll love to talk to you and it's great for him to talk. There was a theoretical possibility if this guy lives, he winds up going to prison.
Yeah.
Because Ina thinks it's a good idea for her husband to talk to people. And it does seem like an interesting conflict from your end. On the one hand, this guy wasn't involved in the murder of someone in 1965. And on the other hand, he's kind of a pathetic, dementia-laden.
I don't know.
How do you?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, the weird thing is I mentioned earlier that we were working on this project and sort of same time we'd go to Selma and stop by the Portwoods and sit up by the cedar trees and chit chat. And then we drive to Montgomery and interview Brian Stevenson about this client of his who's on death row as a black man. And, so we're all, it's like you're juggling these things, and really what we thought about and what we would come down to is we had so many conversations about the, what is the right thing to do? What is the ethical thing to do with a man who is 82 years old and can't remember anything or has just trouble remembering is who do we give the benefit of the doubt to, and we give the benefit of the doubt to people who remind us of our granddads, not to necessarily the man sitting on death row. And so I think where we kind of kept every time we would feel deep sympathy for him, which I still do when I think about him, I mean, we spend enough time to him. And I think this is true of everybody. You sort of fall in love with everybody you spend a lot of time with, even if they're repulsive, just because you're just, the way people talk and you see the human side of them. I mean, all the things that make us human, you see when you spend a lot of time with somebody, even if you're there to try to get them to say something that's incriminating. But I think what we kept coming back to is, we don't deserve to give him a pass. It's not our job to give him a pass. Our job is to get him to tell us the truth about what happened. And then whatever happens, it's not really up to us. And I should add too, that we were talking at this time to the district attorney a good bit about what would happen in this situation? We actually, I think some of that's in the show, because we had another case that was sort of a model for how this case might go down. That was much cleaner than this case. And in that case, it was, it was a pretty unsatisfying solution, which is basically you get somebody to plead guilty and got a super light sentence, an old man who pled guilty to a different murder, the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson. And you know, I can't remember how much time he spent in jail.
Yeah, like 5 months, right?
Yeah, it was not much. And nobody was happy with that solution. And so I think in this situation, it was just much muddier because you'd have to use the 1965 law, and you'd have to sort of go back and think about who did what and who was ultimately responsible for his death. And then there were the quirks about when exactly he died and where he died, and all that stuff played into it as well. So, you know, ultimately, with Portwood, we wrestled with it constantly, you know, and I called Ina right before the show came out, and I just said, I just want to let you know it's coming out. I'm happy to talk to you at any time. Here's how you can listen to it. And I never heard back from her. So who knows?
It's one of the weirdest byproducts of doing this job and doing it for a long time, that you feel bad for people who, when you were younger, you would just dismiss as assholes, and you wouldn't have the emotional, I don't know, maturity or depth. It's weird. I find it weird. I find it weird that there are times when I feel bad for murderers, and I feel bad for even rapists, and I feel bad for people who are despicable, horrible people. And I don't even know why, but I have these pangs of sympathy. And listening to the podcast, even, I felt bad for this poor, pathetic guy who is a complete asshole and a monster in 1965. It's a weird, and I heard when he died, I thought you guys expressed it well. Like, it was like, you found out he died, and you sounded truly devastated. And it wasn't just, shit, we lost a source.
Right.
You sounded genuinely sad that this man who killed someone died.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That you just nailed it, which is, there are all sorts of things running through your head, which are like, oh my God, this woman who, you know, she knocked on the door to try to talk to him and didn't know that he had died. And, you know, we had a Google News alert for his name, but like, there was no obituary until later. And, you know, so the ruining somebody's Wednesday by dropping in and be like, where's Bill? You know, and finding out that he's dead. The other strange thing is, and I don't know if we get into this much in the show, if you can hear it, but, you know, there were some days where you'd go and he was crystal clear. And then there were other days where you'd go and you'd start asking stuff about case and he'd be a little muddy and, I don't remember, I wish I could tell you. And when I went that day and knocked on the door, and Ina told me that, well, I knocked on the door and nobody answered. So I called her from my car out front. And then she said, well, you know, you should know that Bill died. And I was like, oh my God, well, I'm out front. Can I come in? And so I went inside and we talked for a while. But when I went in, Ina was alone in the house, but there were two glasses of water on the kitchen table with ice cubes in them. And I, you know, my first thought is, he's not dead. He's like in the back room, so he's hiding, you know, like he's out, which is just lunacy. But like, it's kind of that's the fever you kind of get in when you're in the thick of something like this. But so going through my head was, yeah, like sympathy for them, for her, sadness that Bill's gone. And then also like fear about the story, for sure. You know, like, is it over? Is it done? Is there anything to it now? So,
right.
It is, you know, I think people, especially now, I think people have there are a lot of just cutthroat people doing journalism out there, but I think that, you know, I think people are surprised when they hear that, you know, you do struggle as a human with these things at the same time you're just trying to do your job.
What are the best tricks you've learned through this besides just knocking on doors and talking to as many people as possible? Like, what are your best, you know, that you feel comfortable sort of talking about, your best research tools that maybe you didn't know about before?
Yeah. I mean, just in terms of doing journalism or making podcasts or both, or?
I guess both. I mean, I just found this a really freaking masterclass in journalism and in research.
Thank you. Journalism. Well, I mean, I think the thing that, so I wrote a book, I don't know, a long time ago, about stone fruit, about a stone fruit breeder in California. And the thing that taught me, that really, I think we all, and Andy's this way with his film work, and Connor O'Neill, who's the other writer of the show, just wrote an incredible book that came out this past fall called Down Along With That Devil's Bones, about the battle in four different cities over Nathan Bedford Forrest statues. We all just love the research, you know. I mean, we're all, you know, I would just do it all day, you know, and not stop, which is the real danger. It's like reading more context. And I think the key, that in terms of the research, is just doing, as this is in the reason I brought the book is this is what I did. I realized when I started working on this book about this fruit beer that I knew nothing about growing trees or breeding fruit or anything or the history of horticulture, and did so much reading about that, probably way, way too much. But I just had to feel like I was in a position to win. You know, another fruit breeder read the book, or a stone fruit grower in California read the book, they wouldn't think, oh, that guy got that wrong. You know, you just want to make sure that people who know the story best, I may not agree with that, but at least they would say that you got it right. And so I think for us, even though we're from Alabama, even though we know this world and we're students in this era, I think there was a lot of reading, I think we did about Selma specifically, you know, and that part of the state. We interviewed at one point, Hal Raines, the former editor of the New York Times, who's from Alabama, who happened to be a Cub reporter in 1965 and covered what he called the Reeb Death Watch at the hospital in Birmingham. And he sort of, you know, he characterized Selma this way as like having a specific strain of sort of says-you-ism, you know, in Alabama. And so we just felt like we needed to really just do just deep dive reading on everything we could related to the movement and to Selma and to the development of the cotton trade and everything. And then just in terms of, you know, reporting, I think the thing that I really fell in love with for this project and sort of probably haunt me to the day I die and mean that I never finished a project because I want to do this for everything is like just primary documents. You know, there was a real like, we referenced this in one of the early episodes of the show, but the judicial archives for Selma, for Dallas County, are in a storage unit, like a 3-room storage unit, like in a lean-to behind an Enterprise rental car on the highway outside of town. And we're talking like Selma for Alabama is a very old city. And so there are legal documents going back to essentially its founding in the early 1800s. Huge volumes of just the legal history of Selma. And in that space, we found the original juror rolls for 1965 that gave us the names. It's the first place we came across the jury pool, which was great because it meant that we were able to sort of track down the jurors. And eventually we found a small reference to them in a newspaper story from 65. That was much later. We found an arrest. Well, we found the warrant for John Lewis, and his thumbprint, you know, for a march in Selma. We found the arrest warrant for the man who punched Martin Luther King Jr. in the nose in the Albert Hotel in Selma. I mean, just historically, like, magnificent documents, you know. And so I think that chase for documents, and I mentioned this earlier, but we had this bait out there of this possible recording of the trial. And chasing that, even though it was sort of a red herring, it really had kind of nothing to do, if I'm honest, like with our ability to tell the story. It was just so fun. And I think we wanted to do that. We wanted to show the process of what it's like to try to find a thing. And even if you can't find it, in that case, it was kind of a perfect metaphor for Selma and for, you know, our reticence to sort of be curious about the truth and to try to, you know, think about ideas that may not be totally in line with our worldview and our identity. Just that process of trying to find it felt to us. I mean, I am a sucker for that stuff. I don't know if you listen to Wind of Change by Patrick Radden Keefe.
I have it on my phone. I haven't listened yet.
Dude, it is so good for that reason too, because it's just like, I mean, it's the ultimate like lark of a story, finding out if this song was written by the CIA. Like, yeah, if it was, it was. If it wasn't, it wasn't. Who really cares? But just the like process he goes through to try to discover it is so great. Right. So I'm just a sucker for that stuff anyway, and Andy and Connor are too. So we just wanted to work that into the story if we could.
Is it hard to work with a partner? Like, is this a podcast, but is it like, God, what the fuck are you doing? What the fuck are you doing? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, in this case, you know, so Andy and I worked together for a long time, had deep, deep trust. We trust each other and, you know, kind of come at things from different angles, but in complementary ways, I think, you know, and Connor, our third writer on the show, producer, same way. We all trust each other and kind of work as in some ways as a hive mind. But still, you know, you're still working closely with two other people and collaborating, and that can be tough at times. And then on top of that, you've got, you know, our crew at NPR that we work with, you know, editors and producers and just trying to navigate all that. I mean, that for me was one of the most exciting and challenging parts of the whole thing, was kind of navigating the writing and the production and all of that with all these other people. I'm just not used to that, you know? But it was fun as hell. It really is so fun to have. And we had just great people in NPR to work with who, you know, you would occasionally get this suggestion. You're like, what? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then like a day passes and you're like, that's fucking brilliant. Yeah, we need to do that, you know? And so that just, it's a very collaborative process. That's messy and kind of hard to navigate at times, but really fun.
I wrote a biography of Walter Payton, and he was on some really bad Chicago Bears teams, and he finally won the Super Bowl, and they were like, Walter, how's it feel? And he's like, yeah, it didn't actually live up to everything. You work and work and work and work, and you work and work and work and work, and you love the work, and then you accomplish something and you're like, oh, that's it. You work and work and work on this podcast, and you work and work and work on this podcast, and you know, it's nominated for a Pulitzer and blah, blah, blah. And it's a finalist for a Pulitzer. And it comes out and then you do PR for it. And then, you know, it kind of, does the end result match the effort put into the project itself?
Well, I mean, what do you think as writing books? Because my experience writing a book was definitely not. I mean, you know, as a Julian Rubenstein who has a new book out, a great writer. He told me one time, he's like, I can't remember I'm going to butcher it, but basically like the pub date is the funeral and the book party is the wake, you know, sort of like, then it's over and you're like, what do I do now? You know? And I think, this has been very different from that experience, and that there's been a lot more media, you know, NPR itself, just being a media company, we're just talking about a lot more. And it's reached a much bigger audience. I mean, I think that's the other thing. But I miss it so much. I mean, I'm so ready to be done with the story and so ready not to go back down to Selma and stop thinking about it. But I also just really, really miss it, you know? And so we're about to start working on a new season, like officially starting on Monday, and which is exciting. It's something that, you know, we were close to starting to work on this time last year and then had to kind of punt for a year. And so I'm excited to dig into it, but I'm also, I think it was, I had this moment last week where we sort of made it official with NPR, and I was like, all right, we're doing it. We're going to start working on this new thing, which we have also spent a lot of time working on already in the past. But it meant, I had this sort of really glum, bleak day last week where I'm like, it means this story is officially done. Like, I got to leave it behind and it's officially over. It's been officially over for 2 years, but there's still, without working on something substantial, you still kind of feel an attachment to it. And now it's sort of like, well, this is time.
That is one of my favorite things anyone's ever said on this podcast. It's hard to explain to people maybe who don't do this for a living, but you become so attached to something.
Yeah.
And you're so ready for it to be done. And yet when it's done, you are devastated that it's done. And you totally feel like your kid just went off to college or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's, I haven't been able to go back and listen to the show. And I don't think I will, because I think it'll just make me so No. I mean, you're listening to it like obsessively, you know, minutely as you're making it. But I haven't listened to it sort of like since it's been released. And I think it'll just make me, I think I'll be like, oh, I want to go back to Selma and do something else, you know?
I just want you to know, I listened to it. It's basically 20 minutes of Madonna songs. It's not much. So you don't have to listen.
Yeah.
Let me say a final thing. I find one of the most fascinating things in journalism, and I've done it a bunch and you do it a ton in this podcast, is that moment of knocking on a door and you don't know what the response is going to be from the person behind. I've probably done it 30 times in my life. People say, how do you do that? You must be brave. And I'm like, I am not brave. It's terrifying every time for me to do it. What about for you? And what was your scariest sort of door knock? if not of this, of your career?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it is terrifying, but I also love it. You know, that kind of like, here we go. You know, and I'm a big guy. I'm like 6'4", and, you know, not insubstantial. And so maybe there's this kind of confidence that comes with like that no one's going to like jump me and beat me up. But still, I mean, there are guns in the world, you know,
you live in Alabama.
Yeah, and I live in Alabama, right? A lot of guns in Alabama. But I, you know, I think the thing that, there's a moment in the show when we knock on the door of a juror and you can hear him. He's like, hello, what are you doing? You know, like two young men. We're not young, but to him we're young. He's 90 years old. Come to talk to me. And then when he finds out what we're there to, he literally like starts backtracking, you know, like recoil and sort of moving back into the house. And I think the thing I love about those sorts of encounters, I mean, I think we were very conscious of there were other moments like that in the show where we went and essentially ambush someone, but we recorded them, but didn't use them because it just feels cheap, you know, to do that kind of, to use that. In this case, we used that one just because it was so telling, I think, about, you know, again, this people who have access to that story, their reluctance to sort of face the truth about it. But I think that, you know, they're always terrifying. And it's funny when you're doing it for audio, you can hear your voice sort of go up like three octaves, like, hello, you know, you're doing the, like, I mean, there's one, it's like, I remember it like it was yesterday. And also I can remember listening to it when we were cutting the episode of knocking on somebody's door and you're just so glad, Handy. I'm like, well, I don't know if you remember me, but we're back and I'm, you know, I'm here with my knives. I'd like to sell you. I mean, you know, that's sort of what it feels like.
Can I talk to you about a man named Jesus?
Exactly. Yeah, totally. But I also think that, you know, it's, so we're, I teach, you know, and I tell students, like, you just, the email and the phone calls often just are so insufficient. I mean, sometimes you just have to do that, but there's something about showing up and there's a moment where it's like, this could happen. You know, if I'd called that juror that I ended up talking to, he would have been like, no, I'm not interested. You know, I mean, I feel 90% sure that certain of that he would have not talked to me. But knocking on his door and chit-chatting and his dog's yapping at you, there's a moment there, you know, there's a moment of unexpectedness where so you feel like anything could happen. I think those are kind of rare. And so I love doing that because it is a moment in the story, a moment in the reporting where it could go one way or another. The one time that didn't work as well in the story was, a guy that somebody told us to talk to really early on, who was not directly, he was a kid, like a teenager in the 60s, 65. But he was sort of, various people said he was his parents had been grocers in Selma. So they knew everybody, kind of a poor section of Selma, where there were both a lot of sort of, his parents Selma passed through their grocery when he was a kid. And so he just got to know everybody. And he was described to us by several people as like sort of Selma's institutional memory, you know, and he collected stuff and, you know, had all this. And so I got in touch with him. And the first time I got in touch with him, oh, he's also friends, I should say, with one of Elmer Cook's, not the son we talked to, but another son of Elmer Cook's. And so the first time I talked to him, he said, well, I've got everything related to that trial on these two discs. And, you know, come down here and we'll talk. And so he dangled that out there and I kept calling him and emailing him and nothing. And I showed up one time and he was like, I'm real busy right now. This guy's in the custom golf cart sound system business, you know, which, I mean, we used to joke, like, it must be the busiest business in the world because the guy never had a second to spare to like go to his desk and get these two discs he said he had. But so one time I knocked on the side gate of his little warehouse and he came out and he's like, I can't do it right now. And I was like, all right, well, I'll check back with you later. And I was leaving and he came out the front door and he had a disc and said, Reeb on it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is it. You know? So I scrambled and like ran to there's a museum in Selma that, I know the director, and I ran over there and said, can I borrow a computer? You know, put the disc in. And it was like B-roll footage from, you know, NBC News or something. I mean, it was like nothing. There was no sound. And so it was interesting to see these men and see the jurors, but there was it was nothing usable. And so then it's sort of like, well, this guy doesn't have anything. You know, like he thinks he's got something, but he doesn't really have anything to be telling. But he did say he had two discs. And so I just kept calling him saying, like, thanks for this, you know, and I'll bring you this one back. Can I get the other one? He's like, you know, I'm really busy, really busy. So finally, one day we go over there, and I'm with my producer from NPR, and we knock on the gate, and he comes, and he said, I'm super busy. And I said, look, you know, if you don't have it, it's totally fine. I don't enjoy coming here and knocking on your gate and disturbing you. If you don't have it, I'll quit bothering you. And he just leapt at me and like grabbed me by the throat and sort of shook me and then like let go. And he starts screaming about throwing me in the trash can. It's a 70-year-old man, but he's a strong 70-year-old man. But he said, you know, he wouldn't actually talk to me at that point, but he told the producer, tell him I'm going to put him in a trash can. You tell him I'm going to put him in a trash can, which I just love. Cause like, I don't really quite understand what that means. I think I know where you're going with that, but like, it's such a specific image. Like I'm going to put him in a trash can. But it was like one of those moments where it just backfired. I mean, it's kind of great. We weren't rolling, so we couldn't use it and probably wouldn't have anyway, but like the sort of door knocking had reached its limit at that point. But I think it also revealed that he didn't have anything that he could share with us.
Did you buy a sound system for your golf cart?
You know, it's funny, as my office right here is across the street from a place called Smitty's Golf Carts. And I've been like, I need to go in there and just ask them if they know anybody in the state who could customize my audio system for the golf cart that I have and see what happens. But yeah. If you ever need that, let me know. You're a sports guy, you know.
You know a guy. Let me ask you a final question. I kept thinking about this during the podcast. So right now in America, there's this real thing going on. Obviously, you're aware of it, with the lie over the election. And I saw a poll the other day that, I don't know, 55 or 60% of registered Republicans believe Donald Trump, that the election was stolen and that there was this thievery. And I was thinking as I was listening to your podcast, how a huge percentage of whites at the time, and probably still now, truly believed that Black civil rights workers killed this guy. Like, that's what happened. They actually ended up killing him because he would become a martyr for the cause, blah, blah, blah. And I really kept thinking about the parallels, how people, and I don't know what it is. Is it that people believe what they want to believe? Is it that people are we just a gullible species? I just don't understand how these people could believe that all these years later. And I think some people probably listen to your podcast and still think, no, they're just NPR and fuck them.
Yeah.
This is what happened.
Yeah, well, that guy that I just talked about, the golf cart guy, is active on Facebook and has repeatedly said, like, I'm not going to listen to that garbage. But those guys, you know, those guys are just regurgitating the same old thing that has always been said about this case. Yeah, I mean, it was very strange to be working on this story during the Trump era. Because I think, like you said, the parallels between the lies, the sort of easy lies that people believed between then and now were pretty remarkable. And I think, you know, I think there's a great essay that came out in Harper's around that time, early 60s, Hofstadter's, I can't remember what it's called, the Paranoia of the American Mind. I'm butchering the title, but American Style of Paranoia, I can't remember. But it's just like classic dissection of the sort of history in America of believing those sorts of lies. And I think, you know, it's just the truth of the matter is, I think it's just so much easier to believe a lie than it is to do the work to find out the truth, you know? And so I think we're all inclined in some ways to believe things that just uphold our identity and our worldview. And we're disinclined to really do too much work I think a lot of journalists do this for a living. And so they kind of have the muscle built up for it. But I think, you know, most of us are just not interested in exploring how we might be wrong, you know, cause it's hard. It's a lot harder than just being like, yeah, you know, I saw things with my own eyes and those things and the things I heard from my parents. I mean, you'd hear that all the time in Selma, you know, like, well, My neighbor, the postman, said he saw all sorts of carrying on down in the tents on the march from Selma to Montgomery. And so if you kind of start there, it doesn't take much to just sort of buy in, especially when everyone around you is saying that the civil rights movement is about sex and drugs, that's all it's about, and that, of course, Martin Luther King's a communist. Like, why would he be trying to, disrupt democracy and use these tactics that have been used in other places that are un-American? And so I think, now it's just been, I'm not going to be saying anything original here, but now with social media, we just have this inclination, I think we've always had, just is able to get magnified and distorted and manipulated. I mean, when you have people sort of willing to believe something because of their political affiliation or because of their religion or because of their just background, and then you've got people who are actively trying to manipulate those people to believe, or really not even to believe something. It's not even propaganda as much as it is to disbelieve everything. I mean, I think that's the real crisis now, is instead of believing a lie, it's disbelieving everything, believing that everything is a lie. I've seen it in my dad, who has always been a reasonable person. And now he's just sort of like throws his hands up and like, they're all crooks, like that kind of, that's the real, I think, danger now. But of course it has its roots in people spreading lies for their own gain. We just now have a master of disinformation and manipulation in Donald Trump.
They're wearing MAGA hats as they storm the Capitol, waving Trump flags.
Antifa.
I've never seen anything like this. I was like, he's done. This is it. This is it. This is the one. He has to be done.
We have relatives who live in Virginia. My wife's, but we have some relatives who, it's really eye-opening, because they're sending us stuff that is, you just can't imagine how they believe what they believe. And if you do kind of a forensic analysis of the links they send, and it's easy to see, like, if this is what you digest, then of course you're going to believe this stuff, because that's all you're getting bullshit. That's all you're being fed.
Yeah. Well, listen, freaking podcast was amazing. It's probably my all time favorite. And
thank you, Joe.
Yeah. I appreciate you doing this. I feel like it was just journalism at its best. And
I really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank today's guest, Chip Brantley, for joining me on Two Writers Slinging Yang. You can learn more about Chip at chipbrantley.com and go to npr.com/whitelies to learn about and listen to White Lies. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Singing Yang, please consider going to the vehicle of your choice and giving the show a nice review. I make no money for doing this. It's all about word of mouth. Music is by the terrific MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.